Hello and welcome to No Directions 2017 Gen Con Seminar Coverage. Special thanks to our Gen Con volunteers, Eric Bring Knives and Andrew Mullins. For more seminars and other great Pathfinder content, visit NoDirectionPodcast.com.
Everybody, thank you for coming to Starfinder 101, the panel that I hope this is.
It is.
I'm pretty positive yes. It is. Let's go down the line and introduce ourselves real quick, starting with...
Hi, I'm Owen Casey Stevens, and I am the design lead for Starfinder.
And I'm Amanda Hammond-Koontz. I'm the development coordinator at Paizo and a member of the Starfinder design team.
I'm James L. Sutter. I'm the creative director on Starfinder.
And brand manager.
And brand manager. I am the guy who oversees all the things and who tells Owen he can't do a weasel gun. So, I know, right? I'm that guy. Blame me. Owen's the good one. This panel, I think we could go through and just be like, what is Starfinder? Let's go through all these presentations. But I have a suspicion, who here knows a little bit about Starfinder, has either read the book or read some blog posts or something? Yeah, I kind of figured a lot of people would not be here if...
Does anyone need a quick overview of Starfinder? Because we can do one if it's useful to anybody.
Yeah, we'll do a quick elevator pitch, and then we can get into some of your questions.
Yeah, I'd really like this to be mostly a Q&A, where we find out what it is you guys wanted to know that made you here instead of in a game somewhere. So let's start with just a quick elevator pitch for the game.
So Starfinder is a D20 game. It is the rules are evolved from the Pathfinder role-playing game, and it is basically the universe of the Pathfinder role-playing game set hundreds or thousands of years in the future. So it is science fantasy. We still have spells and gods and dragons and demons and devils. We just also have jetpacks and holy plasma cannons. That's the elevator pitch.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. Something that I often say that's a little more... I don't think I'll get sued for saying it. I want Starfinder to do for space opera what Shadowrun did for cyberpunk. You know, I want to take, you know, that Star Wars flavor, but then meld it with the classic fantasy of something like Pathfinder and really see what that's like. So... with that in mind, what questions do you guys have about Starfinder? Why'd you show up?
Don't be shy, anybody.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, right there.
Have you already decided, or are you just kind of sweeping under the rug what happened to Galarian? Not if you're ever going to reveal what happened, but do you actually know?
We absolutely know. That was something that when we first started this thing, we were figuring out, like, you know, the gap and all these things, gods that have gone missing and whatnot. It's like, okay, we need to have a document where we write down. I sure hope I wrote it down.
Oh, yeah.
I
know where it is on the server.
Good. Don't tell them.
No.
We decided we needed to know all of that stuff, even though, as you say, like, much like Aridin, actually probably even more so than the death of Aridin, we never plan to tell you at this juncture what happened to Galarian. Like, that is one of those things where part of the reason Galarian was removed was both to create a big mystery, but also because we really don't want anyone to feel like Starfinder invalidates Pathfinder. Because it's the same universe, but Pathfinder is still going strong, right? And it would be really unfortunate if in Starfinder you could just log on to Space Wikipedia and be like, I wonder what happened to Cheliax? Oh, hey, look, Andoran won, like, 10 years after modern-day Pathfinder. That would make, you know, the big Cheliax versus Andoran adventure really unsatisfying if you already knew the ending, right? So that's the purpose of the gap and the fact that historical records... aren't really reliable anymore. People know about what happened recently in Starfinder, and they have some ancient documents that are reliable from, like, Pathfinder's history, but they don't really know anything about that interim period.
Yeah, they are aware there was a place that was called Cheliax. They know some of what came about during Cheliax, but they don't know what happened at the end of Cheliax. So, in a lot of ways, the time period that encompasses the gap starts the day after your campaign ends.
Yeah.
So anything you're doing, but what happens at the end of that, no one knows.
Yeah. More questions.
What else we got?
Right over there.
In Pathfinder, you kind of had an escalation issue with skills. It's an old thing that's with this particular type of game system where you might have a skill that starts off at a base. You know, it's a hard lock, it's a hard trap, whatever. And then all of a sudden you get up to, like, level 10, level 15, level 20. that hard lock is no longer a hard lock. It's real easy, and that makes sense. And you end up having to have these crazy, complicated traps, something to validate a much harder DC. Is that still the same case with Starfire?
So there are there's a game mechanical question here and there's a world building question here. There are two ways a game can settle this issue. One is to say that a hard lock is a lock that we think at your level you need to roll a 15 or better on a d20 to beat. But that means that as you go through your career, you actually never get better at anything because you are always running into things that are exactly fine-tuned for what you are doing. And that's not the approach we want to take. If we say that in world this is a hard lock, we mean that when they're stamping it at the manufacturer, easy, moderate, hard, that stamp is the same universally. But, especially in a world with super advanced technology and AI and stuff like that, those stamps, even at the factory, hard, super hard, stupidly hard, but these things are more and more and more expensive. So just like you don't end up putting your wallet in a bank vault that you stalled in your house at night so your 20 bucks are safe, yes, we assume that you're going to get better and better and better at skills, and therefore more and more challenging things have to come along to challenge them. But there's an in-world logic that if you are a 18th level character, you're not trying to steal a 50-credit cell phone. You're trying to steal the program that controls an entire infonet for an entire planet that allows you to control the whole population, and the security on that will be better.
Yeah.
So just like monsters, you know, a goblin does not necessarily get harder to kill unless he gains levels. But we then have hobgoblins, and then you have bugbears, and then you have half-dragon fiend goblins, and there are more difficult things as you go along.
More questions? Really? Okay. Yeah.
Was Iron Gods an inspiration or a playtest?
It was definitely an inspiration and not a playtest, because it used all of the Pathfinder system, right? There wouldn't really have been any feedback from it that would have been useful mechanically.
Yeah.
That said,
it's not entirely true.
Well, I mean, there was a little bit of stuff, but it, you know, wasn't going to be a playtest because it wasn't a different system, right? It was absolutely an inspiration. Like, really, the things that let us know that we could do Starfinder were the Iron Gods AP, which everybody was really enthusiastic about, and we went, oh, people actually like this whole like laser guns with their barbarians. And then also Distant Worlds, which was a campaign-setting book where I got to go ahead and detail all the other planets in Pathfinder's solar system in the Pathfinder setting. And that was really a chance for me to, after many years of trying to squeeze science fiction and science fantasy into the setting in weird little corners, like there's a particle accelerator in Belkson, you know, that kind of thing. This was a chance to finally just go nuts with that. And to our surprise, the audience really resonated with it. And so I think at that point, Eric started going, maybe there's something here.
And, of course, the technology guide, which we did for Iron Gods.
Yeah, exactly. It was wildly popular.
Wildly popular. You know, still one of the top sellers in the campaign setting line. It has been reprinted, which is a very rare thing for us.
Although one of the things we should point out is people often ask, like, oh, well, the technology guide, does that work for Starfinder?
Yeah.
And the answer is no, because they're different game systems. Yeah. There was definitely plenty of inspiration that came from the technology guide. But the technology guide was designed for a game where a laser pistol is a really weird, rare, interesting thing. Whereas Starfinder is a game where we expect every level 1 or less person to be able to go out and buy a laser pistol.
We assume there are Abadar Corp vending machines for laser pistols where you can just drop in 100 credit coin and it'll spit out a brand new laser pistol with your favorite pop star on the side.
Yes, exactly.
But also, I mean, Iron Gods was an inspiration, but also a lot of us at Paizo are fans of a lot of the older pulp and science fiction stories where science fiction and fantasy got mixed all the time. Sort of the idea that your fantasy and your science fiction should never be blended, you shouldn't get your chocolate and my peanut butter, is not original to the genre at all. And of course, D&D had, you know, Expedition to the Barrier Peaks and such, which a lot of people loved. And there's a Dragon magazine adventure where you go to London, for example, and the original Baba Yaga's Hunt has an aircraft carrier in it. So that sort of blend of elements has always been in the role-playing industry, but also just even in fiction, right? I remember one of my favorite Fawford and the Grey Mouser stories. They run into an alien in a spacesuit riding a giant snake speaking German because that's what the guy wanted to write when he was doing that story. So we've always felt that a lot of these elements go well together, and Sutter and several other people have been putting a little more and a little more and a little more in drips and drabs in Pathfinder. But there is a level at which you have to say, well, that won't be Pathfinder anymore. And so this really is, those are all neat, those are great, we've talked about that. Now let's see what happens if we crank this combination up to 11.
Yeah.
But it was always there from the beginning. Like, even, like, so when I was writing the original Gazetteer for Varisia and Pathfinder Adventure Path number 3, the original draft of that, I had, like, a space elevator right in the middle of Varisia. You know, one of those, I think it was, like, the Spire of Lemris or whatever. Mm-hmm. Originally just a space elevator, surprise. And James Jacobs and Wes Schneider really had to, like, sit me down and be like, okay, this is cool, but you need to walk it back, son. This is the wrong flavor. But
you go to Nemeria, and a lot of that flavor is still carefully
exactly,
put there.
Right?
So,
but we've all been trying to sort of play with that for years. So, more questions? Or we could just run through stuff. Yeah.
You have the Starfinder version of Bestiary coming out soon-ish.
Yeah.
Yep, 2 months.
The Alien Archive?
Yes.
Yep. That's what it's called, yeah.
No, it's not.
No, it's a couple of months. We wish it was out.
Yeah.
It would be.
It's on your store already.
There's a thing
called. It's been listed, but it's up for pre-order.
And there's a thing called First Contact, which is a sort of a short, early bestiary that you can use if you want to shoot things now.
Yeah, totally.
But with that one, you're going off a lot of detail of alien creatures and a whole bunch of intelligent races. Are you going to come out with a planet version of something like that? Or a flora or fauna version of that, where we actually get to know what horrible poisonous plants are on this planet?
You mean stuff that's a little less like monsters designed for encounters,
right,
and a little more just setting
gazetteer setting stuff?
I mean,
we've been
somewhat
doing some of that.
Yeah, like we are going to do a big setting book called The Pact Worlds. That'll be sort of your core setting, expanding on what's already in the core rulebook. It'll be kind of like the Intersea World Guide is for Pathfinder. This will be for Starfinder. And that will actually have significantly more sort of crunchy player-facing bits and GM-facing bits in terms of there's going to be new playable races and, you know, new weapons, new spells, new all sorts of stuff like that. But sort of I think for the time being, like, for stuff like Alien Archive, we're really trying to focus on getting a bunch of creatures out there that people can use in encounters, because you can borrow from Pathfinder pretty easily.
Yeah.
But we know that, like, here's this big game, but, you know, one monster book is not going to feel like very much when you're used to playing with 6 bestiaries and 10 years of Pathfinder APs to draw from. Like, we know that there's a fairly limited menu right at the start. And that's one of the reasons, actually, why it was so important to have backward compatibility with Pathfinder, so that when you go, what are they going to fight? You know, you've got a couple hundred pages in, Alien Archive, but then you've got, you know, the ability to pull in, say, you know, whatever random, you know, Lantern Archon, great. Well, we're not going to spend valuable real estate in Starfinder, probably, doing an updated version of the Lantern Archon. We want you to just pull the original one.
Yeah. We certainly aren't going to try and update 6 bestiaries worth of monsters,
exactly,
right? If there's something like, there are dragons in Alien Archive, because dragons are iconic, and we want to make sure we tell you, hey, here are dragons. But the other, and Alien Archive does have things that aren't intelligent, that aren't people, right? So we do have just some monsters and some dangerous plants and stuff like that in Alien Archive.
And that said, like, we also have a pretty diverse array of back matter material for our adventure paths. We are doing one-page write-ups of just random planets outside the Pact Worlds in each volume. So, and some of them have a little bit to do with the adventure. Some of them don't. They're just cool, interesting things that we wanted to put into the setting. There are, of course, you know, the Alien Archives, a bunch of monsters that are relevant to the adventure, especially early on, because we needed monsters for you to fight.
Yeah.
But there are also gazetteer articles. There are setting articles. We've got a giant Absalom Station article in the back of Incident at Absalom Station. We've got other planet articles. We're going to be doing one on Eox for the third one, for example. Is Castrovel? Is there Castrovel 1 and 2? Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, so there are, and so that does have some of the information we're looking for about, you know, what types of plants are there, what types of other hazards are there, what
weird
are
animals.
Yeah, exactly. Animals, flora, fauna, you know, what are the things that you encounter when you would go to those types of places. Same thing for the planets. We're telling you what the gravity's like. We're telling you what the atmosphere is like. We're telling you, you know, what are the cultures on that planet like? What are adventure scenes for there? So so there's a lot of different bits and pieces that you'll be able to pull from the different sources.
And another important thing about Alien Archive is that the monster creation rules in Alien Archive, and this is not hyperbole at all, You can make a effective, interesting CR-16 monster as a GM in 5 minutes or less.
Yeah,
It is not a huge involved process.
Yeah, it's actually, in many ways, it stems from the philosophy that was presented for the monster building in...
Pathfinder Unchained,
yeah. And we thought that that was actually really important, both because on our end, it sure would be nice to be able to make monsters easily,
yeah.
But we know that Starfinder is inherently a game about exploration, even more so than Pathfinder, because here you are, it's the beginning of sort of faster-than-light travel, and you're in a galaxy with billions of planets. The reason for that is because we want GMs to be able to enjoy the creation of a setting. You know, if you have an idea for a weird planet, set a session there. Just have your party go there, play a little quick one shot, and then fly back to Absalom Station and go somewhere else. You know, we really want that to be part of the experience, because for me, new settings and seeing new places are the thing that I enjoy most about fantasy or science fiction role-playing games. So we're trying to really encourage GMs to both play in our setting, but also make your own elements, add them in. You're not overwriting anything.
And that last bit is really important. I know there are people who, if they're playing in a Pathfinder game, they want to set it in Galarian, and they don't want to say, hey, there's a... Hey, there's a small town outside of... the city of Absalom, and I'm going to call it this, and I put these NPCs here. They don't want to do that because they're afraid we will then show you a map of that whole area and their city won't be there and they feel like they've been invalidated. In a galaxy with billions of planets, we are never going to map where everything is. It's just, not only is it impractical, it's literally physically impossible for us. And all travel is based on how long it takes you to get there, which isn't about actually where it is, it's just about how many hyperspace beacons are around. So any GM can say, hey, out in the vast where it takes this many days to get there because there aren't many hyperspace beacons, there's a planet of sentient donuts, and they need your help. And if that's what you want to do, you can rest assured we're never going to outline that section of space and say, of course there are no sentient donuts, right? Yeah. It's a huge galaxy, so you can do anything you want and never have to worry about us saying that particular section of space is empty.
Yeah.
So it opens up all of these possibilities to work with and expand off of what is our canon to make your own canon.
And that's one of the reasons, though, I should point out that we are so heavily detailing the Pact Worlds, which is just one solar system, is because if that sounds great to you, as it does to me, like, that's awesome. If you find that super intimidating and you're like, I just want to know the setting so that I can set my stuff there, well, the Pact Worlds are that. It's a great home base for adventurers. It's, you know, going to have enough of a consistent feel, enough information that you can feel like, okay, maybe I want to play on Akaton, and I'm going to learn Akaton really well and, you know, get into the lore and whatnot, because that's also a fun part of the game.
We did actually have a question.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I actually...
Oh, sorry.
We had two.
You
we'll
and
get
then,
you next.
Know, right, in
no
the
worries.
Front. Yeah.
Okay, some of the Pathfinder adventures have, in fact, taken us to Akaton, and,
yeah.
Like, it would be pretty neat as a campaign if details from that were carried over, but do those worlds also have this big gap in their history?
They do have the gap in their history, but that doesn't mean that details don't carry over. One of the reasons why it was really fun to make this in the Pathfinder setting rather than just creating a whole new game universe is that we want to see how certain details have changed and evolved. You know, what's the same and what's different is where the fun Easter eggs come in, right? So, like, if you look at Akaton is, you know, physically very similar to how it was in Pathfinder. A lot of the same settlements are still there, but they're now futuristic, right? You know, a lot of the same physical features. So when we change things, we're often changing it for a specific reason, so you can be like, oh, well, that's interesting. That one planet or that one city is now totally different because
yeah.
of X, Y, and Z.
It's got
Z.
The same name, but
yeah.
this is the way it's evolved.
Yeah, it's designed to be sort of a hook thing to get you interested rather than just changing it for changes.
And I've done some, I know a lot of us here have done a lot of writing on that Pact Worlds book that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And I know that personally that was a thing that was really important to me. I was writing up the Triaxis article and, you know, we've published a lot about Triaxis, right? Because of Green of Winter, you know, Distant Worlds had a lot of information. We had the big gazette here back in, was it like 72 or 73, something like that. And so it was really important for me to, you know, absorb all the information, reread it again, you know, make sure that I remember, you know, what we've said about it and sort of like pay respects to some of that stuff and mention some of that history and say, you know, in ancient times, and it's, of course, you know, like sort of surreal to, yeah, to yeah. be mentioning ancient times Pathfinder, but to sort of lay that groundwork and then build upon that.
Yeah.
And add new details and say, you know, this is what's changed, you know, here's how the gap has transformed the Skyfire Mandate, and, you know, here's how we've, you know, brought the Skyfire Legion into the future, and here's how, you know, the dragons and the humans and how all of that conflict has sort of, like, changed and resolved itself. And it's really, really interesting to bring that into the future and to use options that we could have never touched in Pathfinder, right?
Yeah, and we felt like it was really important to, like, when working on sort of the initial concept for how have the planets changed, it was important to me that, like, all of them have updated somehow, but that we make very deliberate decisions. Like, for instance, on Castrovel, the Formians and the Lashunta are no longer at war.
Yep.
There's recently been a peace there. And so how does that change the world? You know, and some stuff has changed dramatically. Like, I think probably the biggest change was Apostate. Do you want to talk about how we changed Apostate?
So how many of you know what we're talking about when we talk about Apostate?
Okay,
like
so
two people. Okay,
yeah.
So in Distant Worlds, there is Apostate, which is a sealed world that has a whole bunch of chambers in it that was theorized was probably some sort of generation ship or vessel that was from the outside of the solar system anyway, and had the Ili, which were a weird race that had a bunch of different forms. There were legendary chambers of life. There was a whole bunch of stuff that we talked about, and unlike things like Triaxis, we never really did a lot with them. And then we're going in the future. We're like, well, we could still say that all that stuff is still in there, but that's just sort of taking the same world and moving it over. Or we can pick something interesting that moved there, because a lot of the races that came from Galarian had to leave if we want them in our setting, because Galarian's gone. So now the Drow are masters of the outside of that planet. Drow arms dealers with orc and half-orc mercenary armies that they will rent out for the right amount of credits. And they delve into this planet, which is practically a planet-sized dungeon. They will send expeditions in to try and find that ancient technology, to retro-engineer it for more weapons to sell to other people. So we get to have, you know, the Drow are a secret in Pathfinder, right? Most people don't even know they exist. Now they're running a world, and their whole culture has adapted to having that world. And the fact that it's pretty dark isn't really an issue for them. So they are now the masters of their own planet, and they have their entire economy, and they deal with other people, and they've got a representative on the Pact Council. So that lets us take some of those tropes that, because of how we set things up in Pathfinder, are limited in what we can do with them, and go a really different direction with them so that people who want to play with those things have new options.
And we had a second question right back there, yeah.
It wasn't so much about the game itself, but more about you guys. I mean, you guys, I'm sure, play so many test runs, and when you made the story, are any of the characters, like when you guys were making Starfinder, are any of you guys' personal characters, like, implemented in the story that are kind of like your heroes that our characters get to meet and kind of become part of our adventure?
So we carefully crafted the Starfinder iconics to represent stand-ins for player characters. And we did play tests with a lot of Iconics builds, none of which survived to the end of the process. So the pre-gen Iconics we have out there are the end of the process. They're not what we were using in the beginning. But we learned a lot as we were doing that. Some of our characters are referenced in the book, like when we're talking about, we have an example of play.
Every time we do an example of play,
right,
actually, all the names are pulled from people's real office characters.
Yep.
So you can see sort of almost transcripts of us playing,
yeah,
kind of thing.
And then I, at least, and I bet other people who are designing it, I will sometimes go a different direction. Like, I had an NPC I really loved in a Star Wars game I ran, which was not based on anything from Star Wars. That was a neat name and a neat concept. I just did that in my home campaign, so no one else owned it. I will put that in as an NPC on a planet. So in that regard, some of the stuff that we've done are NPCs you'll run into and people you'll interact with. But we have carefully only done that and crafted them when that's the appropriate thing to have there, right? It's we do get to put in our own little Easter eggs. I showed up at Sutter's office and said, I want size medium albino space minotaurs. And he was sufficiently tired that he went, fine, just write them up.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember that conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
That was hilarious. You were super nervous about, like, he's going to shoot it down.
I asked for one thing in the Alien Archive, one thing, and I'm getting it. And they're called the Noir, and there's going to be, like, five people on the planet that'll know why that's cool, and I'm one of them. but so that kind of regard, you can take stuff that you think is cool and carve out a little corner for it.
Yeah.
So albino, size medium, space minotaurs, yes. Weasel guns, no. That is where the line
there's
is.
There's a give and a take, right?
Yeah.
Right. And there's totally a lot of things in there that are our little personal babies, right, that we were like, I really want to do, like, a planet that is this thing. And one of the places I think that that's reflected the most in the setting chapter is probably in the Beyond the Pact World section, because we have, of course, the Pact World's write-ups, and they're gorgeous. They have these beautiful, full-bleed, double-truck arts, and they've got, write-ups about, what's there and everything and all the stats that you need to know. But then after that, we have a whole, I think, like 6 pages or 8 pages, so somewhere in the realm of, like, 16 new planets, 2 per page, that are, mostly, I think it's all in-house people wrote those. And so we had
a brainstorm. Chance for the existing staff that weren't, like, because somebody had to work on Pathfinder, right? Starfinder, right? And so we
it's
wanted
funny,
to make sure,
it's true.
We wanted to make sure people weren't left out.
Absolutely.
So Amanda kind of headed the project of making sure that everybody in the office who wanted to write a planet got the chance to invent something just whole cloth, not working on something that was already done, but just like come up with a planet and put that in there. And so that's.
Yeah, we had a meeting in which we wrote down probably 50 different concepts of planets, and then we voted on them, and then there were some that rose to the top and some that were just like, yeah, we're not doing that in there. But,
no sentient donuts.
Yeah, no sentient donuts. But, we have like a toroid planet in there, like a round planet that has different gravity depending on where you are, and that's John Compton's baby. And he like got really granular with the details of the science of how it all works and how, animals have gravity blasts. And, there's this culture on this side and this culture on this other side, and they never meet because they have to, have different gravity to be able to physically withstand it. And it's super awesome and complex. We had somebody else who really wanted a Dyson sphere planet, and I believe that was Judy Bauer. And so she, came up with this big backstory about why this Dyson sphere planet is, half ripped apart because of this big conflict that had happened in the ancient past. We've got, I got to do my sort of anime-inspired type of planet. It's a planet called Dimalco that is part, Knights of Sidonia and Evangelion and a little bit of Attack on Titan, in which most of the population is kind of underground, hiding from these giant colossi creatures that awakened in this event that happened, in the way in the past.
It's Kaiju World.
It's totally Kaiju World. So it's like this ruined planet and all the oceans evaporated. It's totally weird and out there, but, it's all the cool stuff that we all wanted to do that we got to put into the book. And so that's probably one of the places where you'll see the most of that.
Yeah, exactly. And like same thing for me. Like there are a few characters that carried over, that not from my personal, like not characters that I played, but characters that I've loved for a long time. Like Karsai the King, who exists, who's like sort of the leader of Octurn and may or may not be Nyarlathotep, all of these different things. But for me, I had the incredible luxury of, since we were basing a lot of this on distant worlds, like kind of the default was my baby. Like all of those worlds, which made it really nice because then I could feel free to let everybody else kind of do whatever they want with them because I got to lay the foundation. And so that was really nice.
Let's see, what else we got? You got any other questions for us?
Yeah, right there.
The adventure path you're doing now goes to level 12.
Yeah.
Is that the level ranger aiming for adventure paths, or do you have plans to do up to level 20?
Well, so it is, in terms of just how far we can get, I think that sort of like 12-level window is definitely going to stay the same just because that's predicated on how many words we can get in the book. Where that starts and where that ends can definitely shift around. So I don't think it's a given that all adventure paths will start at level 1 necessarily. Like we might very well say, okay, well, we did 1 to 12. What if we did 3 to 15? What if we did, these other things to try and give people some chances to play at different levels? But that said, I don't really expect us to ever be able to get, 1 to 20. So that's hard enough in Pathfinder, and those are significantly longer.
One of the really interesting things is that we are at the beginning of Starfinder as a product. So we get to sit around and say, do we want to do things the way that Pathfinder did things, Or have we learned things from Pathfinder that we want to apply because we're doing it for the first time? Or are the needs of our game different, and therefore we should come up with a different solution? We literally have meetings where we sit around and say, what's the smartest way to do this product? So, for example, some of the focuses on Alien Archive aren't just monsters you shoot and kill, but a lot of those we also say, you can also use this as a player race, and here are the rules for that. Because in a fantasy game, frequently you don't want to have a 27-person room without a single human in it, because that seems weird. But in space, you've got the cantina scene. So the idea that maybe there are a billion races out there, and some of them are in a hyper-intelligent shade of blue, is more in keeping with sort of the space opera science fantasy setting. So that's a different approach. We also said, well, we want to make sure that giving you a lot of options for easily and fast making characters, that's a different approach. In addition to player races, we want to put some of this alien gear in here because there's literally whole different kinds of technology. So we can say, hey, here's a weapon that only these people normally use. Here's a equipment with, and the summoning spells are in there. So that there's more player-facing stuff in here, so that a player doesn't have to say, "Well, I'll buy this, but I have absolutely no use for it."
Well, the number one reason to buy it as a player is like, do you want to play a giant floating space jellyfish?
Right.
How about a hyper-evolved brain person that just floats around with your little atrophied body hanging underneath?
And so we're able.
I want to play that.
We're able to take that idea. Here's a book, a whole bunch of things that are alien creatures, and present them differently than we did in a bestiary, so the book serves more purposes. We are looking at that for the adventure paths. We certainly don't have anything ready to announce, but are there ways we could potentially someday have an adventure path that goes to 20? There are ways we could do it.
Yeah.
Some of them might just randomly be, like maybe we'll do an adventure path that we say, hey, start your character at level 12. By the way, if you've done this adventure path and your characters went to 12, feel free to do that and then start this as a second leg, or just start here. So that would be a way we could potentially do those things. We're sort of trying not to get ahead of ourselves and focus on what we actually have to produce now, but these are all things that we look at and are possibilities.
And we are also going to be looking very carefully at the feedback over the next year. Like, you know, one of the things, so obviously the adventure path has changed format fairly significantly in Starfinder from Pathfinder. It is so much shorter. It is bi-monthly instead of every month. And so those were very deliberate choices made in part because, oh my God, there's not that many of us. Like, we need to, you know, scale things back a little bit. But in part because, you know, one thing that we've noticed is that a lot of people start adventure paths. A lot of people never finish adventure paths. And as a, you know, as a GM and a player, like, I actually find it somewhat unsatisfying if I am constantly starting campaigns and then make it halfway through and then people go, well, this is cool, but, like, here's this new shiny thing over here. So some people have, you know, definitely online have been like, oh, my God, the adventure paths are shorter. What the hell? But in some cases, that's a feature because it means that you can get through more adventure paths. You can have more full, completed story arcs. So that's a thing that we're testing to see if people like that, right? If after people play for a while, they're like, actually, these adventure paths are way too short, well, that's really something to know. It may be that people say, actually, these are still too long for us to get through, in which case, maybe, I don't know, maybe we do 2-3-part adventure paths a year. You know, like, there are a lot of things we can play with in Starfinder that we feel like we can't touch in Pathfinder because they are the way that it is always.
Because we've been doing adventure paths for a decade in Pathfinder.
Yeah,
so.
And so we're intentionally, with kind of every aspect of Starfinder, we're going to get crazy. Like, we're gonna do all sorts of different stuff and see what people like. So please do let us know.
Paizo.com. We have Starfinder forums.
More questions. Let's go right there real quick.
Hey, so I played a couple of different sci-fi type RPGs.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have been really deadly, and some of them have been very abstracted and not deadly.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think that Starfinder falls in that?
We had so many fights about this.
Right in the fun zone.
Yeah, I think it's in the middle.
And where does that fall for you, Owen?
So, I want people to have to not be stupid in a fight. So it is certainly possible to die. There's a thread right now that on Paizo.com. Played my first Starfinder game. We all died. So it certainly can happen. And the fact of the matter is that when you reach the unconscious stage, it's actually deadlier than Pathfinder, but it's a little harder to get to that point. We've evened out the damage progression some. We have a set of points that it is very easy, of life points, we call them stamina points. It is hard to recover those in combat, but easy to recover them out of combat. When you run out of those, you take hit points. It is easy to recover hit points in combat using resources, but there's no better way to restore them out of combat. So the cost to your character very much depends on how hard was this fight. If you only take stamina, which is usually around half your points, then at the end of the fight, you all can go, okay, we're going to take 10 minutes, we'll burn one resolve each, we get all of our stamina back, all of it. That is one of the things that allowed, I did a playtest with 4 soldiers. No magic healing whatsoever. They did fine, because they killed things so fast, because they're all soldiers, that they tended to only suck up stamina damage. The flip side of that is that if they bit off more than they could chew, at the end of that, they'd be out of their stamina and have taken half their hit points. They're like, well, I can take one healing serum each, and we can get all of our stamina back. But now we've really got to worry about, can we take the next fight? We have the stamina. Let's be a little more cautious. So it's a balance that's designed to create both of those environments. You're not going to die just because you got a bad die roll. But if you get stupid or bite off more than you can chew, you can be in trouble. But we do make it easy to reset because we're trying to avoid the 5-minute adventuring day. Right? We want you to be able to get all your stamina back without having to burn major resources, without having one character whose job is to heal you, so that you can go to the next encounter or the next encounter and keep playing.
But the actual decision of where to put that sort of like that death point was really contentious, because I feel like on the one hand you had Rob McCreary was like, I love my character, I want my character to survive, and me was like, kill everybody. That's like, I love when my characters die, and I, you know, both as a GM and as a player, like I find it really fun to die memorably, and so there was a lot of like arbitration going on over here between those two sides, yeah. Of like, nah, it's fine, just kill him. It's like, do you understand how sad that is going to make some people?
I think death and dying is one of the most contentious rules decisions that we had to make, because it's basically a subsystem and it's very new. It's different than the way it works in Pathfinder.
The whole life energy, death and dying, healing, all of that. And that created some interesting design spaces, right? Because the Envoy is the only class that can restore stamina in a fight.
Yeah. Only to one person. To a limited amount.
Well, it can do it to everybody, actually.
Okay.
It's just that each person can only get it once before they burn a resolve point.
Gotcha.
Which means that it's not a limit on the Envoy. The more people you got, the more the Envoy can heal. Mm-hmm. But the Mystic is the person that is most likely to be healing you out of combat, to do hit point healing. So depending on how the fight goes, the value of those characters changes, which makes tactical options interesting.
Yeah. New person back there, yeah.
So speaking of the 5-minute adventuring day, how long is the adventuring day in Starfinder?
10 minutes! No, that's not true.
In terms of encounters or what the goal was or anything like that?
So we want you to be able to all decide to take a break at the same time. I don't care if that's 5 minutes or 5 days. To me, the important part is you don't have the cleric or wizard going, I refuse to keep going forward, I'm out of spells, while the fighter's going, but I still have stab. I haven't run out of stab. I have all the kinds of stab. My class is built on stab, but I bought a lot of it. So one of the things with resolve points is that every class gets resolve points, and resolve points is how you get back your stamina. So if you all got chewed up pretty badly, you probably all burn a resolve, and as long as you can all do that 2 or 3 times, you're fine. Because soldiers are more likely to have blast than stab, they may have some concern about wanting to get back to the starship and recharge batteries. They may have some concern that I don't want to get into too many fights because I'm going to run out of bullets, although bullets aren't all that expensive, depending on which bullets you buy. So everyone has some resources to manage, and the idea is that you will go through them at roughly the same rate. But also, if your technomancer does run out of spells, your technomancer has a blaster pistol. Your technomancer may have a grenade. So there are... If a sorcerer, after third level, if a sorcerer runs out of spells, you will not convince your sorcerer, you've got a crossbow, you'll be fine. When you can tell your sorcerer, you've got a flamethrower, they tend to go, yeah, I do. That's fair. The entire set of technology options changes the whole dynamic of a game in ways that really wasn't even clear to us until we were playtesting. I ran a game at PaizoCon where the soldier discovered that they had a jet boots and could charge as a standard action and had a big alien space lizard axe. That is the happiest I've ever seen a player in my life. Because as a move action, they can run around a corner, and then as a standard action, fly 60 feet and hit someone in the head with a space axe. That changes what that character can do, and you then don't have the sorcerer. Well, I'm flying, so your stab is irrelevant, and I'll just drop a fireball at you. Well, I'll throw a grenade up at you. So the whole resource management game is different. In my experience, smart players will get through anywhere from 4 to 8 encounters, depending on how chewy they are, and dumb players are dumb players, and will always... None of you, obviously, but there are some, I promise.
But I do think you touched on sort of one of our big design principles. As we were deciding what things to change and what things to keep the same from Pathfinder, it was often about trying to figure out how can we make groups work better together? How can we sort of find the parts about Pathfinder where, because we all clearly love Pathfinder and have been working on it in some cases for 10 years. But what are the areas where we find the consistent sort of pain points where it's like, you know, this has always been a problem. You know, stuff like the 5-minute adventuring day. And so you'll find that most of the changes that were made either were made for theme, stuff that just we needed to change to get science fiction.
We need to have a laser at first level.
But a lot of the times the stuff about the math that was changing or the sort of crunchy rules was, how do we make this just a little bit easier on everybody? How do we make it easier to work together?
And several people on the Pathfinder design team have credits with 4th edition D&D and 3.5 D&D and some other games. I was one of the playtesters for 3.0 D&D. I worked on the Star Wars role-playing game and Gamma World and Thieves World and Wheel of Time. So every time you do a game that is in any class level based game, but especially a D20 based game, you learn a little more about what works and what doesn't and how things interact. Obviously, I hope we got it perfectly in Starfinder, but we may fine tune as we go, and we will get feedback from people. Yesterday, thousands more people had access to the game than the day before yesterday. So obviously, the field of people looking at it and trying to find problems just exploded.
Owen's email is going to be a disaster.
It's going to be hilarious.
I suspect it is literally on fire. Hilarious.
Yeah, exactly. So much. Somewhere back in the office, Lissa is like frantically slapping at a flaming server.
Yeah. And there will be stuff that we didn't get right. But when we didn't get it right, hopefully we're close and we can fix it.
Right.
Let's go right back there.
You mentioned that a lot of people who are kind of married to the D20 system have been working on it for a long time. Was there any consideration from deviating from that and going to a D6 system or a D10 system or something like that?
A conversation was had. It wasn't long.
Yeah, it was very little, because here's the thing. We knew that our audience knows how to play Pathfinder. So we could do something wildly different and run a vastly larger risk of the fact that all of our audience would be like, yeah, but I like playing Pathfinder, so no thanks. By making Starfinder as close to Pathfinder as it is, we really were hoping that people would be more willing to give it a try. Because I'll admit, there's plenty of great games where I'm like, that sounds super interesting. I do not have time to sit down and learn a whole new system right now, which is one of the reasons why oftentimes when that used to happen, like Wes and I would take settings that we liked and just use the Dread system because it's so easy to port everything in there. Or be like, okay, we're playing Mass Effect in Pathfinder, that kind of thing. Because it's easier. So we wanted to make sure that it was a simple step, especially since we wanted to keep the same universe.
And I think originally the idea has held true that it's going to be on a Pathfinder chassis, right? But we ended up making so many more changes and adjustments and new systems to make it appropriate to science fantasy that what we really came up with was, I think, a really nice blend of the very core essence of the Pathfinder D20 system, but with exactly what you need to play the types of stories that we want you to be able to tell.
Yeah. And there are 6 Pathfinder bestiaries. I am not aware of any game that has as many monsters in it as Pathfinder does. It would just be a shame to not take advantage of that and say, hey, with a little work, and other things to convert take more labor, but with a little work, if there's something, some 27-legged evil plant in Bestiary 5 that you want to put in your game, and I pulled that at random, but there's about a 50-50 shot there is one, you can do that. And the further we moved from basically making this a D20 system game, the harder it would be for that to make sense.
I think I saw a couple other questions.
Yeah, we got time for a couple more minutes. Kind of speed round. We'll start right there.
I was just curious, you guys put a lot of sci-fi stuff into Starfinder, obviously, like the starships and power suits, which is awesome. Was there ever any consideration or thought about, like, mechs?
Mechs, I cry a single tear in that mechs were one of the few things.
When I first heard of Starfinder, I was really, really looking forward to mechs because I like Mech Warrior, I like Star Siege, you know, stuff like that. And
BattleTech.
When I looked in the book, it's like, oh,
every reasonable person wants mechs in Starfinder. And so
all right thinking people
are
with
you. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Scotsman. So that is absolutely on our list of things to do. It is one of the top things I say when you say what didn't fit in the core rulebook. Because the core rulebook is so tightly packed because we needed a game as big and robust as Pathfinder. Okay, so imagine the Pathfinder core rulebook. Plus we want, like, at least 60 pages of setting material. Okay, well, that's another book. Plus we want, you know, a starship combat system and, of course, pre-made starships. Well, we'll add that on. And really we should have a lot more material sort of, like, introducing the game, teaching you how to play. Great. So that's now an 800-page book. We can't even bind that. And so we had to figure out how to condense everything in order to get it in there. And, man, were we, like, every word, every page cut was painful.
There are two things that I would have loved to have in this book that aren't there, and that is mechs and Fist of the North Star style space apocalypse martial arts. For both of those, in the end, the decision was do it now or do it right, and we decided it was more important to do it right. So these are on our radar. We just couldn't get them in this book.
Fortunately, we plan to publish more books.
Yeah. So if you want to see those things, go buy, well, okay, not here, but as much Starfinder stuff as you can, and that will encourage us to keep putting stuff out.
We had a new person right there.
So for Pathfinder players switching to Starfinder, what do you think is going to be the sort of biggest change that they're going to have to get used to mechanically?
So first off, we should note, in the Sagamore Ballroom right over there, there is a handy one sheet printed out for you that you can pick up that Owen created that is some just basic differences between the two games. So, like, sort of a cheat sheet for, okay, you know how to play Pathfinder. You want to play Starfinder. Here's some stuff to know right off the bat.
This literally grew out of me writing this up for people to run the, for Paizo employees to run this at PaizoCon. So I wanted a cheat sheet. I made it for myself and one other person, and then everyone had it. Now it's officially laid out and edited. Thank God it's edited.
Yeah.
So to break it down, you need to learn resolve points, stamina points, hit points. It's not that complicated, but you need to know them.
Yep.
You need to grasp the fact that you get a single attack as an attack action, or you get two as a full attack action, both at -4. That is true pretty much at all levels, and no matter how many arms you have.
Yeah. Different armor classes.
We have kinetic armor class and energy armor class. Flat-footed is just a condition, so it's not a separate AC. We don't deal with touch attacks, so that's not a separate AC. So we used to have three ACs, now we have two and a condition. Those are actually the biggest. There are no components for spellcasting. There's no verbal, no somatic, no material. Turns out in the future, you just make magic with your mind.
Also, there's no arcane and divine division.
Yep.
Like, that's more of a world thing, but, like, magic is just magic now, and different classes, you know, cast different parts of it, but it's just magical phenomena.
Every character class can wear light armor. Every character class has small arms, so no matter what, you can wear a Kasatha weave cord and have a laser gun. Those are some of the basics of the differences. And there are some other stuff we mentioned, but we had some of our translators in that translate Pathfinder into other languages, and so we were running the game for them so they could decide, do we want to sign a deal to translate Starfinder? And one of the consistent pieces of feedback we got was, oh, a lot of stuff's different, but I know how to play this game already. That was really encouraging for us to have someone that is even learning the game in a different language, be able to look at what we did and say, oh, I see, you changed this, 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 and this, but the core experience is still, I have stab.
Yeah. Okay, one last question, super fast. Yes.
I have a bunch of players at home who say, I love D&D, I hated Gamma World. I love Pathfinder. Starfinder.
So how do we sell those people?
How do I pitch this to them and put their fears at rest?
If you don't like space wizards and laser ninjas, I'm not sure I can help you. I'm not sure anyone can help you.
So there's a crucial question on why they don't like Gamma World. If they don't like Gamma World because it's a post-apocalyptic wasteland where you're frequently scrabbling for survival for a canteen, then let them know that you actually get more starting equipment in Starfinder than Pathfinder, and you can go to your local Quickie Mart and pick up a bazooka. If that is their concern, we have it fixed. If it's, I don't like a psychic facing a space dragon who might have a nuclear weapon, then no one can help you.
Yeah. All right, and that is pretty much all the time we have. So thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, guys.
I never get applause at the end of a seminar. That's awesome. Thank you.